Welcome to the Dignity and Respect in Action podcast. This series is brought to you by the UMass Office of Equity and Inclusion and features members of the university community and other experts in the field of diversity, equity, and inclusion. In these episodes, we'll learn about the work and experiences of our guests and gain insight from their expertise. Your host for this podcast is Dr. Nefertiti Walker, Interim Vice Chancellor of Equity and Inclusion and Professor of Sport Management in the Eisenberg School of Management. And now, here's Nef.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for DARIA, the Dignity, Respect, and Action podcast. I am your host, Dr. Nef Walker. Today is the fourth and final episode in our series of podcasts dedicated to Black History and Heritage Month that celebrates the Black experience at UMass. In the last episode, we chatted with Dr. Jamila Liscott and Dr. Keisha Green about the UMass Center for Racial Justice. Today, I'm welcoming two people who are deeply committed to the Black experience at UMass. Please welcome to the pod Dr. Whitney Battle Baptiste and Professor John Bracey as we discuss the Black Presence Initiative here at UMass Amherst. All right, good folks, welcome. Let's get this thing started. I like to start by having each of you give the listeners an introduction to you, who you are, how you engage at UMass, and then a little bit about your involvement with the Black Presence. So we'll start with you, Professor Bracey.
Okay, I'm John Bracey. I've been at UMass since 1972. I teach African-American history and a bunch of other things. And I can give you the five components real fast if you want. There were five things.
Please. Please do.
Yeah, the first one was to name a building after Randolph Romery. And then I thought about it as the gateway to the campus. You know, you walk on the campus, you see the Romery Center for the Performing Arts. I thought that's kind of cool. So the trustees approved that unanimously. No fight at all. That was back in April. We just have to get a formal ceremony now. The second piece, was they were going to move the transfer to Malcolm X Center to the administrative control of the department. But given the pandemic and no budget and no people in the center, that's kind of in abeyance now. And I'm not so sure that we want administrative control anyway. What we just need to do is increase more programming. You know, we can offer classes, you know, I mean, I think if we do more of that, because I teach a class there anyway, that will serve the purpose that I had in mind, which is making it, taking it back to being an academic space. And the third piece is a piece that the chancellor snuck up on me with, and that was the it was actually still the last piece. That was he added in a scholarship in my name without no consultation, nothing at all. It just was in there. And then I couldn't get out of it. But he told me on the argument that I don't get the money, the students get the money. So I said, okay, but like.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then the two big pieces are the website and the book. And that's where all the effort is going, the ongoing kind of work. The website is gonna have two parts. The first part is gonna be, split into two parts. It's an active ongoing part. The whole thing is going up in the summer sometime. There'll be an active ongoing part that will have announcements, interactive things, you know, contact with the alums and so forth. And the part I'm most involved in as a historian is doing the interviews to build up a massive, massive database of reflections on the Black presence at UMass. And so I'm letting the other people do the short things. I'm sending, you know, hour-long interviews over to Blake Spitz in the library. And we've done about 30, 35 or 40 thus far. We've got a list now of up to 200 people. So that this will be the only university I know that will have that body of material on what it was like to be at a place over time. Talking, you know, not just clips, but like what it felt like, classes they took. We're getting everybody, custodians, administrators, faculty, students, you know, grads, undergrads, and it's an amazing bunch of people. And the list is growing because people are calling me. In addition to the website, we sometime down the road, we're going to do a book, you know, a coffee table book, but a little bit smaller, on the Black presence, which will pull the transcripts out of the interviews and add, you know, video and documents, you know, photos and documents, and it'll be something people can hold and carry around, and you can give, if they give contributions, that kind of thing. But what it will do is it will be it will anchor the Black presence as something that people can just walk on campus and just pick up something or turn on the computer and see, because now you can't do that, and they have no idea how extensive it is. I don't think anybody did. That's why they kind of got surprised by the amount of work I was asking to do, because I think they thought it's going to be done in a year. And I kept saying, I don't think so. There's a lot of things I know I get a hint of, but I know there's more there. So now I'm finding the connections, and it's a lot. There's a lot. You know, it's a multi-year research project. And that's what my involvement in the Black Presence is.
Thank you for that. So Dr. Battle-Baptiste, can you please share, again, introducing yourself, your roles, the various things you're doing on campus, and then also talking a little bit about your involvement with the Black Presence?
Sure. So I am a professor of anthropology, and I've been here since 2007. And the types of stuff I teach are about slavery in the Americas, the Caribbean. But I've been mostly encouraged to teach a course on gender and hip hop, as well as things like race in the museum. One of my more recent classes have been Du Bois in Our Time, which is kind of coupling Du Bois's work with contemporary scholars who are trying to address the same kind of issues that apparently still have not changed quite as much as they should. And I also, in my spare time, I'm the director of the Du Bois Center, and we have a vibrant postdoc program where we've been bringing in scholars from all over the country to take the time and relax and be in the archives, of course, pre-pandemic, as well as having a graduate level graduate fellowship. And we do all kinds of programming, Breakfast with Du Bois. We just did our 101st installment of Breakfast with Du Bois on this week, Monday. And we have the annual lecture that started way back, but kind of bringing it back to be more of a community and campus event where we can celebrate the scholarship of people who have been influenced by Du Bois. So that's what I've been doing. In terms of the Black Presence Project, been helping a lot, not necessarily on the technological side, but trying to work on the content side to help with the Black Presence website. And it is to see it from the bare bones and the foundations of a website is intense, just to see how much work goes into it. But I am excited about all of these things coming together and being a space, what Bracey was talking about, in terms of having a space for folks to click in and be able to see that we are alive and well as Black folk on this campus. And hopefully my contribution will be, I don't know, it's going to be very minimal, because there are so many stories about doing a Black Presence tour on our campus. I think that many students that you know are at UMass now, Black and Brown and Indigenous students, perhaps don't really know the history of some of these spaces. And New Africa House alone is a study and a tour that would take you, you know, half a day, if not more, to learn about all of the things that happened in that building. So my hope is to use that tour to kind of put narrative and get some photographs, so that when people look on campus, they can see that, you know, there has been a Black presence here for many generations. And I'm hoping to contribute that part to the website itself and the campus in general.
Yeah, absolutely. Professor Bracey, I want to come back to you for a second. And your process of sitting down and having these interviews and working with Erica, your graduate student who's been working very closely with you to interview folks. Can you tell us just a few stories about some of the interesting aspects of the process, right? I think both, you know, interesting stories that people have shared with you, but also just the process itself of uncovering these stories for this particular purpose.
Well, you start with the obvious. I mean, I think the original thought was that the obvious people were the only people, but they're amazing stories. We've got a couple of millionaires, as Swami found it, they just came to, you know, Upward Bound people. They came in, these majors in journalism or whatever, somehow got into a startup and something, and guys retired as Bippy and gives away a whole lot of money. You get the voices of New Africa House Choir. They are all in contact with each other. And so we're going to do a group interview with starting with Barita Reddy and so forth. And she's working with that. And Maya Cunningham's helping with that. We have already have a Zoom meeting with the athletes, because Bruce Flint has a Zoom meeting with the guys from the Calipari Perry years. And they meet every 2 weeks. All the guys that played on the Final Four teams, all of the Calipari Perry guys, meet in one place. Right?
Yeah.
And I'm letting Mary and Matt do that, because what I found out immediately in the interview process is that my ex-students say different things if I'm not there, because they give me, I said, what would you, I said, you're saying that because I'm sitting here, right? And they say, yeah. I said, okay. So the ones I really want the good stories from, I let their peers interview them. That's why class is very good. Erica asked a question of one of the men that you know, one of the millionaire guys, how did he function being a single parent? You know, his wife worked, but he was stationed at Westover Air Base, so he lived there to save money. But he had two kids, and he only had daycare, was split. You had a morning daycare and afternoon daycare. So he had to schedule his classes around, drop his kids off, take the class, get over there by 12, take him to lunch, then take him to the afternoon daycare, and then take his class and get him out, and then take him home. And I said, well, what was your social life like on campus? He said, what are you talking about? I didn't have any social life. I never saw the campus. Like, I'm home. So you get all these very complicated stories. You get Vladimir doing the athletes. He did all the professional football players, because he's retired from 10 years in the NFL. You know, these are my Haitian immigrant kid. And he just called them all up, and he got them all together. We still have to get Victor Cruz. But Vladimir was also working on his senior thesis with me, which is going to be a biography of himself. Like, how does it feel to be a Haitian immigrant and get all the way into this other world?
Professor Bracey, is this a current student?
He just graduated. He's going to graduate.
Okay, okay, I see.
No, he was a Haitian. He's 10 years ago. He's a really smart guy. But he was 350 pounds, 6'5", and could jump from a standing start onto a table. He could bench press like 200 pounds like 100 times. I mean, he was amazing. But he hadn't played football in the high school, because he came out of Haiti and played soccer. And when he went to high school, they said, why don't you play football? So he looked at film of what offensive tackles did. And so he learned his techniques looking at film. So he comes to UMass and he makes All-American. He gets drafted. He plays 10 years of professional football. And he's retired now. He doesn't need to work anymore. Yeah. And his wife is Haitian, and she's a doctor, and they live in Texas. And he's cool. I mean, he's like set. He's looking after the kids while his wife is there. But he's not a refugee story. What I'm finding out among the African and West Indian kids is they're coming for political reasons. His family moved to Bridgeport because they lost the fight, you know, with Papa Doc and all that, which he didn't know about. I had him write on Haiti in my class because he didn't know anything about Haiti. He's just totally, you know, clueless, and his family never told him. Mutale Bonda's father, you know, Kenny Bonda, he was the women's soccer coach on his campus. Won a national championship, Final Four, 4 years in a row. They paid him less than they paid the men's coach. And he quit and went down to Amherst College. He coached the Malawi national team. He's on the NCAA Title IX committee to get equity in women's sports. I mean, he's a legend in soccer, right? But this campus treated him like crap. He's here because their family, the Bonda family, half of the Bondas are the prime ministers, the other half are trying to overthrow him. So he couldn't start his soccer camp until his side of the family got back in power again. So now he's got a soccer camp that he uses to teach people how to read and write. You know, and his son is in our graduate program, Vitaly. He's a saxophone player.
Oh, wow, that's amazing.
So you got Vitaly separate and his dad separate. They're two totally different kind of vibes. But when you get, you talked about it, something, you know, New Africa House, Shaler Mumba School. We had a daycare on the fourth floor, right? 30 kids, 5 or 6 years old tops, beautiful sound. They come down the stairs at 12 o'clock laughing and playing and so forth. Who are the teachers? Well, if you want African folklore, Chinua Achebe Robinson and reads African folklore. You know, if you want music, Max Roach popping and do your music thing. Why are they doing that? Because their kids are in the Shaler Mumba School. So we're going to interview. There were people here in the 1930s, and there's a very important group that was here at the beginning of the 20th century. from historically Black colleges. They were coming up to take agricultural degrees so they could get Morrell second land grant money. Mm-hmm. You know, when Rob Cox was alive, he told me about these numbers. And I said, who are these people? I said, where are they coming from? He said, they're coming from Black colleges. I said, they want land grant money. They're coming from Tougaloo, Fisk, Howard. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is have one class in agricultural anything and you get land grant money, right? So they send like the English teacher up to get a degree in agricultural science. You know, that explains why you have a congregational church in this town, a Black congregational church. Black people are not congregationalists unless they go to AMA schools. Right? Mm-hmm. So why is there one in Amherst? Well, it's because they're coming up here and they don't want to go to Goodwin AME. Right. So there's a whole network of stuff that we opened up that could go on forever. That's the whole point. You can't do it in a year. You know, these are open.
That's a good point. But I also, that's interesting though, Professor Brace, because what you're uncovering is not just sort of the history of the Black presence on campus, but the connection and how it impacted the broader Valley area, right? Like how the Black presence on campus influenced the Black presence, you know, in Amherst, in Springfield, in the broader Valley area.
If you want another short connection, the people out there that used to do the tobacco, kids from Black colleges, Howard. How do you know that? Because Sterling, that's why they, again, that's Sterling Brown knows Jules Chemeski and Sid Kaplan. Howard kids would come up, they would send faculty up here to look after them during the summertime, right? You kind of have a mini kind of summer school, right? Sterling Brown knew the people up here because some of his kids came up to work in the fields up here in the 1940s, 30s and 40s. So when he found Sid up here, and Sid called him and said, I need some Black grad students, do you have any? That's when he sent Mike and Esther and Eugene and Terry to start who started our department,
right? Yeah.
There's an intersection with this area that goes back to the abolitionist days, the American Missionary Association, you know, land grant money, you know, Amistad money, it's the Amistad money. And that's the picture you want to paint. Like, it's not just a college out here in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
It's connected to a broader kind of set of historical circumstances. Connecticut River Valley, you got Sojourner Truth over there in Florence. Why? Because you're on the Connecticut River. Black people didn't walk to freedom, they got on a boat. So why would we have to walk 300 miles if you can get on a boat and come up the Connecticut River and to get to Canada? You had to walk to Canada.
Yeah.
That's in TV stuff. You know, Black people come up, you get off a boat in Long Island, you know, you come from the South, you land in New York, you get a boat coming up the Connecticut River and you go all the way to Canada, but you stop along the way. Where you stop? Florence, Northampton, Amherst. So that's where we live.
Yeah, so Professor Bracey, I think this is a perfect moment of you sort of telling the history and those landmarks of the Connecticut River, for instance, to transition to Dr. Battle Baptiste and talking a little bit about with her, this virtual tour, right? Because you're mentioning things that perhaps we might see on this virtual tour, right? These artifacts that are outside of our campus that had such a significant influence on, you know, both who we became as a campus, the Black presence on campus, but also the Black presence beyond this geographical region and how UMass Amherst was a significant piece of that. So Dr. Battle Baptiste, if you could for a moment, share some of your thoughts. I think, you know, broadly speaking related to the Black presence, but also the idea of trying to capture some of the material, some of the artifacts on campus, beyond campus, and how that might influence what we see with the website.
Sure. I think that a big part of what I want to do, and this is, you know, it's time consuming, is to actually listen. And I know it's to also speak to Professor Bracey, but because he has so much knowledge, that is taking out those bits and then seeing if I can translate that to where this was, what are some of the things. And it's going to be a process of listening to a lot of the interviews, right? Because I think that what Professor Bracey is talking about is that we don't experience the campus the way students that go here do. We don't, as faculty, we don't experience the campus the way staff do, the way custodians do, the way folks that you know, worked in the different capacities. And I would like the tour to kind of center New Africa House, but not as a starting point? Because I feel like sometimes if you don't have a starting point, I feel like, it, you know, you have the potential to get lost. Yeah, but what this is actually also working with Special Collections and Blake and Erica and trying to listen to some of these interviews about what happened and how people interpreted these particular, you know, big events that stood out in the minds of students that went here. So I think that it is a, it, I know that it's gonna take longer and I don't, than this short span of time that I have, but I know that there is the foundation there that we can get on in the summer so that people get excited about what's coming next. And I think that it's not something that I think would take away. I mean, it's research in itself, right? If I can help with, you know, helping out finding that one picture that needs to go in the book for this, then I hope to help with that. And so it's a team and a collaborative effort because we cannot tell this story just one. It's a collective effort for all of us to understand the experiences that each person that stepped foot on this campus had.
Yeah,
I think that's important. It's something that both of you have said is this idea that although we have this date in mind, right, end of summer, beginning of fall, we want to have something visual on a website for folks to look at. You both have alluded to the idea, which is absolutely correct, that this lives on. Like, this isn't something that we can stop. If we're calling it Black presence, then that in and of itself and the name of what we're doing means that it lives on and we continue to work on it and build on it and evolve it over time.
The other thing that's really good that we don't notice, at one point we had one third of the Black PhDs in math on this campus.
Oh, wow.
Don St. Mary, Nate Whitaker, Floyd Williams. There were 10 Black mathematicians with PhDs in the whole country. A third of them were on this campus. The other two of the women were down in Spelman where my daughter went. So that's like half of the Black PhDs in math are within touching distance, right? Yeah. That's important. Nobody knows how important that was, right? That's a rare kind of occurrence, you know, in any kind of academic institution. And talk about the first thing. We taught the first hip hop course on this campus, right? 1996, you know, I had to cover for an undergrad and an A&R guy from Time Warner, Will Strickland. And my department didn't want me to continue because they said we were getting money from the record industry. And I said, well, that's who has money. Where else you gonna get it from? we had the first conference on Black studies, women's studies. Joyce Berkman and I taught the first class, graduate class in the history of Black women in the whole country.
Yeah. Oh, right? Wow.
Joyce and I taught the first class on African American Native Americans, taught by an African American and a Native American. And I didn't think much about that till you go to a powwow, people walk up and talk to you and say, like, how do you know me? He says, no, you teach with Joyce Benson. How do you know that? He says, everybody, you know, I mean, Native people, they know stuff. So people give you stuff at the powwows. You know, you look there trying to buy something and they say, no, take it. You know, you're teaching with Joyce, you're helping us out. And I'm not thinking that, I'm just teaching something I find interesting. But this is important in somebody else's world. That the Afro-Indian connection is here, tied in with the Wampanoags and the Cape Verdeans. So you can't just say Black in Massachusetts because you're very confused in about 2 seconds. You know, you got to say, well, what kind of Black is this? They say, well, I'm Cape Verdean. But you from Cape Verde? No, I'm from Fall River. Like, what's with that? You know, and with my mother's Wampanoag. So that's why they call themselves Wampanoag sometimes. The mix in this thing, the ethnic mix is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, phenomenal. You know, and we could have had Portuguese studies on this campus, you know, Afro-Portuguese thing, but nobody wanted to do it because they thought it wasn't important. So now they have it down at Dartmouth. But I wanted to do, you know, the Brazilian immigrants coming in, the Cape Verdeans are already here. We've been sitting right there to do that, to make it part of our diasporic focus. But you have a vision, but then you have to talk about why would you have that vision? Because you look at your student body and you look out there and you got Barrows and Carreras and Lopeses and so forth. This is not Georgia name. These people ain't coming from Mississippi and Georgia with those names. These are Portuguese names. So you got to deal with that. You got to add them into your syllabus. So when I taught the survey class, I would add books on, well, some people came before the Mayflower. Some people came in the middle of the 19th century on whaling ships.
Yeah.
And so you have to teach the reality of the world we're in as a Black world. It's not just a regular, you know, it's not a straight step kind of world. And that's what the interviews will show, because we interview interviewing all the kids of Fall River, New Bedford, you know, Sid Pereira and Rick Towns and Paul Barrows, you know, the heads of SAMHSA were Cape Verdeans. Substantial part of our Black student body were Cape Verdeans. And we can't make like they're not there, because that sets the tone for the campus, and it sets a certain set of relationships for the campus. And there's a lot of that that we just haven't even, you know, like we got to do Taj Mahal, because Taj Mahal went here to the ag school and his brother ran the barbershop in New Africa House. So I'm going to do both of them. I'm gonna, you know, Taj was here in the 50s, his brother was here when New Africa House started. So I'm going to do Taj and his younger brother, right? Nobody knows Taj Mahal went to U.S.
Yeah. Professor Racy, you bring up something that's really interesting to me. And Professor Battle-Baptiste, feel free to jump in on this one. But my research in the business school, I study organizations. And at this moment, at least, I'm really interested in understanding how we conceptualize entrepreneurship by Black people, right? So Black entrepreneurship, what does that look like? How do we teach it? How do we embrace it? How do we empower students to understand it and go out and become entrepreneurs? And a lot of what I've heard from both of you, the idea of the barbershop, for instance, the idea of, you know, basically having a childcare facility, you know, in New Africa House. And the idea of, I've had students that I work with in Eisenberg that, you know, they braid, you know, the hair of all the football players, for instance, right? Like they got their own business in their res hall, braiding hair, doing cornrows, you know, freshening up folks' locks, for instance. And these are, this is business, right? This is quite literally business. So I know for me, I'm trying to understand, how do we highlight that? How do we tell those stories in Eisenberg? How do we shed light on the ways that Black folks on this campus have engaged with entrepreneurship?
Look, they're having those kids that do t-shirts.
T-shirts,
basketball player, the guy's trying to sell me his specialized socks, different kind of colors and all that. And I said, no wonder y'all lose engagement. He said, he's walking around with sock designs. He said, look at this. I got this new line of socks coming up. I said, shouldn't you be in the gym? You know, no, we have all these kind of things that are going on, but everybody's got a t-shirt. I've got an office full of t-shirts produced by students, you know, and some of them work, some of them don't work. It's running the barbershop. We had a barbershop. Yvonne had a restaurant. You know, we did our own things. You interacted with people from Springfield. You know, the Nation of Islam used to bring a bus up to pick up people on Sunday to take them down to Springfield. You know, you had small stores in Springfield run by our grads. I mean, there's a network here that if we look at it that way, it's much richer than just skirting the surface. And that feeds into the Springfield League, you know, which is all the ministerial group. You know, most of the ministers of the major churches in Springfield, especially the Church of God in Christ, they're our grads. Mm. You know, Talbot Swan and what's his name, Bishop Robinson, they're UMass grads.
Yeah.
You know, the head of all the cultural centers are UMass grads. You know, they take something from here and go back and do something down there. Part of what the Black presence is making that connection so that we don't think Springfield is like on another island somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, some alien kind of place. You know, that's why it's a complicated thing. You know, that's why, you know, you can't do it in a week. You know, you have to think those things out. You have to go into the networks that go all the way back. You know, our first secretary, Norvell Jackson, her father had the largest Baptist church in Springfield, Reverend Hamer, Faith Baptist, you know. And so you had an automatic entree into Springfield through Norvell's father's church. You know, I got invited to speak that day during Black History Month. Erica's grandmother was Eastern Star. She was the head of the Women's Masonic Lodge in Springfield. She invited me down to talk to the Masons in Springfield. Otherwise, how would I know how to do that? I mean, how would I make that connection?
Yeah.
You know, Ruth Loving got a degree. You know, Ruth died a few years back. She lived to be 100. She did everything that moved in Springfield. You know, she got people to come here. Then she came here, got a UWW degree when she's 75 years old. She danced in the cotton club.
Yeah.
She came to Springfield, worked in the armory. She got the first radio program for Black people. She's the one that got the Martin Luther King holiday. That's why all the Black police show up, because she tells them, well, Miss Loving doesn't ask you to do things. She tells you what to do. You know? And she lived to 100, and she still was working in City Hall when she was 100 years old.
So to your point, those are the stories, right, that we want to tell. Those are the connections we want to make, because in some ways it feels like obviously there are people across campus that know these stories individually, but having a place, having space, creating space where we can collectively, you know, embrace, discuss, acknowledge, amplify these stories, I think is really important. And I think that's the goal of this Black Presence Initiative, is to do all of that.
You want them in the mix, and you want them to know that their experience is valued. Because that's the first question people ask you. It's like, what are you going to do with this? Are they going to listen to me? Can I really say what happened? Or do you want me to say how great everything works? I don't want to do that. Do you want the PR picture, or do you want what happened? I said, well, we actually want both. So give me 5 minutes of how successful you are, then tell me all you had to go through to become successful. And those are two, it's the same story, it's the same person. I'm a millionaire now, man, but they called me names in the dorm. Mm-hmm. Nobody studied with me. I didn't have a study group. The white kids didn't talk to me in class. Mm-hmm. Like, I did this on my own. You know, I mean, that's the kind of thing you're talking about. I'm the only person in my geology class. I'm the only person in my physics class. I'm the only person in my computer science class. You know, and they say, but I did it anyway. Or you come in and they think you're not who you are because of what you do. Like John Tate, who played basketball, is one of the 10 vice presidents of American Express. Right? Now, nobody thought he would do that when he was here playing basketball. You know, he's a basketball player. They didn't know he's a business major because they didn't see that. Yeah, that's there's a lot there.
I agree. And I think having someone, you know, like you and Erica and others that are working on this with you, the students even, developing that trust is important to the stories that we're going to get. So I want to try and wrap us up with one last question for you all. And, you know, this question is, what does this look like if it's successful? Right. So if we put this energy and this time that we're putting in, that we have been putting in to the Black Presence Initiative, you know, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 10 years from now, what are some of the things that will signal success to you? And we'll start with you, Professor Bracey, and we'll end with Professor Battle-Baptiste.
Well, the obvious thing is you can click on the university website and Black Presence will pop up and you can find out what's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can find out, you know, what your classmate did. Did he just won a Nobel Prize or not? Or you can find out what the new events are coming up. Like you won't, oh, I missed the Malcolm X picnic. Well, it'd be on the website. You don't have to click 5 times to find it. It'd be right there. I mean, that's the stuff you need to know. Or if you want to get in contact with somebody, you can say, I'm looking for everybody, class of 75, get in touch with me. I mean, it will be, you know, a kind of megaphone for the village of Black people that came through here, and a place where they know they can go to get accurate, up-to-date information and report back. You know, I just had twins, you know, I just got promoted. So it'll be an interactive live thing. That piece will be new and different because we don't have that now. It just doesn't exist now, right? To put it in print form, it's always good. People feel good about themselves if they can pick up something that has them in it, you know? So the print volume in and of itself will be, even if it's not gonna be complete forever, just the idea of having, well, this is the Black Presence, you know, up until 2021. Yeah. Just so you can carry it around, put it on your coffee table, show it to your kids, flip through there and show, well, this is me playing this and that. This is me in the classroom. That physical manifestation that you were here is important. You know, you go out to the mall and you see all those little books from different things, you know, what happened in the world, what happened what happened to Black people? Like, where's our little book? So we want our little book to be up there with all the rest of those little books, you know. And the basic historical part is that people will know how great this place was during the second half of the 20th century. This is a phenomenal institution. You know, it's known everywhere around the world except on this campus. You talk to any musician anywhere in the country and you say you mad, they say, oh yeah, man, when y'all gonna bring me up? There are people that are still mad at me because I've never invited them to come do a concert because they wanna know, am I not good enough? Because everybody knows only the best musicians come to UMass. You know, so they're saying Jessica Taylor Moore stays on my case because y'all should get money for her. She wants to bring her all women's orchestra, 20 people. And I said, can you break it down a bit? She said, well, I can bring 10. How about 5? And you know, her career won't be complete until she comes to UMass.
Yeah.
You gotta come here. This is where you go. This is where Maxwell, this is where Archie was. This is where they had bright moments. Back when it was free in the old days. Right? No, musicians know this is a place that they were welcome. That Yusuf is here. You know, Roland Wiggins was here. Reggie Workman lived on the campus. This is a very special place to people that are not sitting in the middle of it and thinking it's not all that.
Yeah.
You know, and the people that came out of here, you know, the women administrators that came out of here, we had two college presidents come out of my department, two college presidents. Mm-hmm. I mean, what department can say that? You know, people outside know that, but nobody inside notices that. And they think, oh yeah, some black people up there. Blah, blah. Say, no, it's not just some black people. You know, we transformed the place and the place is still transformed, you know, but nobody has laid that out in a way that people can see it. And the black presence will be a way you can look at that, see it.
Thank you for that.
Well, I think that part of the way to measure success is that hopefully it won't just be black folk looking at this information. And it will be used by our faculty on this campus who seem to, not pointing fingers, but I think that sometimes when you get caught up in teaching your courses and or whatever it is, I know that for me, coming from, you know, a Black Studies tradition, it is impossible for us to be faculty on a campus without building community, right? Yeah. Because we cannot, and I think what might come through more frequently is this idea of having to literally create the spaces that now I can maybe reflect in some kind of a format that's not gonna disappear. And I think that is important so that maybe even faculty will use it as resources. Orientation, when you should not be saying the Webb Dubois Library ever, right? But you also should know that there was a real struggle in creating or naming the Dubois Library, right? It was a grassroots struggle that wasn't faculty saying, this is the way we're gonna do it, but it was students. It was faculty and it was a collective. And so I think those kinds of movements, the fact that the Che Lumumba school itself existed is testimony. It's not just black folks wanting to be around black folks. Folks were having problems with their young children in these racist institutions. So what do? You say, okay, how are we gonna change it? Collectively, you build a community and you say, well, we're gonna name it. Let's bring these three names together and keep our children safe. And I think that those kinds of, we had the numbers to do that, right? And I think that those are the kind of stories that once they're not just in the air. Like, so if I know about those stories because I met the people who were involved, right? Mm-hmm. Or I know Professor Bracey, or I don't, you know, try to avoid New Africa House, right? So all of these things are because I purposefully went to find community. And I'm hoping that it will also have a slight influence and maybe a little shift in the way our non-Black folk look at our history here, because we've been here a long time.
By doing this initiative, by having these interviews, having these conversations, I think a lot of what we're going to find is we're going to have a better understanding of where we need to move forward with some of the work that we're doing related to our Black African American students on campus, right? Like, and our communities beyond campus. I think just what you mentioned, this idea of creating courses, creating content, engaging with the Springfield community, that's something that we might need to revisit and have a conversation as a campus to see, why aren't we doing this? Are there opportunities for us to do this moving forward?
Yeah. You're following home. Like when Talbot Shaw started his Black History series, Lift Every Voice and Sing, I gave the opening lecture because he didn't know how it was going to work. You know, he said, I got this idea. You come down here, give a lecture. Now the thing has been going on like 10, 12 years now, and it's big, you know. But suppose I said, I don't have time for that. When am I going to get paid? None of like that. You know, I said, no, this is a former student of mine. You know, church ain't that big, but I love his church. You know, Spring of Hope. I mean, I love Spring of Hope. And you go down there and you talk. And he now has everything broadcast all over the place. So if we're in that world, like, we will have access to students all across a huge chunk of the country because of the Church of God in Christ, who might think there's a school up here they might want to go to that they never would have heard of, right? That's the payback for that for the university. It's like, I know you're not going to put me on a plane to send me down to Florida, right?
Yeah.
But if Project has a convention in Florida and you showing a professor from UMass talking in Talbot's church, then they'll say, oh, there's something going on up there. That's how you contact Black people. Not with
absolutely.
And if you don't go to the college fairs, you don't contact them at all, you know. But we're not going to do that. I don't think we're going to do that too much. But we have networks. We just don't activate the networks, and we have networks. I mean, that's what's so frustrating about it. It's, you know, we just don't turn them on. You know, we got light switch. Turn it on. Just flick the switch, and boom, we're right there.
So, Professor Bracey, Professor Battle Baptiste, this can go on forever, right? I feel like I could talk to both of you about the Black presence, about both of your different perspectives and different approaches to working on this for hours and hours. But for today, we're going to end here. I want to thank you both so much for being here with me today to talk about the Black Presence Initiative at UMass. I'm so appreciative of the work that you're doing to collect and tell these important stories about the Black presence at UMass. Dr. Battle Baptiste, you know, we're tapping into your expertise in uncovering the material cultural artifacts of the Black presence, of the Black experience on campus. And I certainly think this is absolutely important. And I think in a lot of ways, you're the perfect person to be leading this particular part of the project. So I appreciate you. And Professor Bracey, again, we joked early on that you are Black history at UMass. And I think there's some truth to that. So we're absolutely happy to have you a part of this project and leading, again, your unique part of what we're doing. So thank you all for tuning in to the Dignity and Respect in Action podcast. Be sure to tune in next week when we will be kicking off a month-long series on women and gender diversity with the director of UMass Amherst Stonewall Center and the Trans Policy Clearinghouse Coordinator for Campus Pride, Dr. Jenny Beeman. Thank you.